right? That could be generated, I remind you, by constructing a transfer matrix. What's a transfer matrix? It's this object here, where I multiply a bunch of R matrices, right? And then there was an operation that from this transfer matrix, I could extract a local Hamiltonian by taking the derivative of this transfer matrix at a particular value of U. And because these transfer matrices, they commute for different U's, for different arguments, I can diagonalize them all at the same time. And that's what we did. We found what's the eigenvector psi of this transfer matrix T hat, where again, this T is this transfer matrix, where I remind you the notation, a line is associated with a particular spectral parameter. In this case, the argument is U minus I over 2. That's the spectral parameter associated to this line. And then I multiply a bunch of R of U, which means that the bottom argument, I can imagine it to be 0. Okay? U minus 0, U minus 0, U minus 0, it's always U. How do we construct this state? By multiplying a bunch of B operators that are made of the same material of the transfer matrix, the same structure, except that instead of taking the trace, we do the most natural thing to create excitations. We insert a spin down and remove a spin up. Therefore, this spin down needs to go somewhere. And therefore, this puts an extra spin in the spin chain. Right? So but instead of tracing, I put a down and remove an up, the down must go up. So the state up here has one more spin down compared to whatever I insert here, because the spin has to go somewhere. So these operators, after acting n times, create n spin flips compared to this state. And what is the eigenvalue? The eigenvalue is this expression here, right? Which is a polynomial. And why is it a polynomial? Because these poles are not real poles. They cancel because of these bit equations. So this is really a polynomial equation. And what do we do with this eigenvalue? I remind you. Because the energy is the log derivative of T hat, right? The Hamiltonian, sorry. The energy is the log derivative of T without hat, right? Which is the eigenvalue. And I compute the log derivative. I remind you, we shift by I over 2. This term was irrelevant. And the log derivative of this term gave us the nice energy of each magnon. So this is the energy of each of our magnons. And finally, just for summary, let me remind you where this came from. These factors here, this and this, they came, this was the operator D acting on the vacuum, right? And I remind you that this D acting on the vacuum, what we understood at that time was, D was the one where I put down and down, was that the weights are completely fixed and each weight gives U minus I over 2. So that factor there, I can think that that factor is just the product from k equal 1 up to L of U minus I over 2. Okay? And the point is that if instead of 0 here everywhere, I add some parameters, those parameters would appear here. They don't appear because I put 0 everywhere. But otherwise, if I put here A1, A2, A3, A4, A5, AN, they would just appear here and they would modify this term here. But because we chose zeros everywhere, that's why we got this term. And similarly for the first term. That was the origin of this term. This term here came from the algebra. This term came from the algebra, from these algebra relations that were derived like this by crossing these lines. And this, you see, depends only on this R matrix here. Doesn't care about whether there are zeros here or not. So if I were to change the zeros to something else, this part would be untouched, and this part, I would have to change these zeros to something else. Okay? Just keep it in mind, because later today this will be relevant. Okay? So is this clear? Okay. Then what did we say? We said, let's take L to be very large. Let's go to the antiferromagnetic case. And the claim is that we should take, in that case, N1 real roots, which are very large. And in fact, are approximately equal to L over 2, close to L over 2, and N2 strings, N2 objects like these strings, whose number is order 1. A bunch of this. When we did it, we analyzed what are the effective equations for the center of mass of these strings and also for the holes, right, which were the roots that were not chosen amongst the real roots, and we found this set of equations here. M is the number of holes, K is the number of two strings here. Theta is the position of the holes, and capital U is the position of the two strings. And the spin is M over 2 minus K. Okay? Is it clear? So these are called nested bit equations. So let's remember what's the physical meaning. So we start first with everyone up. This was the ferromagnetic vacuum. Right? From here, we went to the antiferromagnetic vacuum. The antiferromagnetic vacuum is just a big mess. It's a complicated singlet state. So instead of drawing it, I just draw like this. It's some vacuum. There's nothing. So this was done by putting N1 to be L over 2. So there were no holes. M equals 0, K equals 0. Then, after, what we do next is we put some holes, which means that we consider N1 smaller than L over 2, but first let's still consider N2, which is K to be equal to 0. Okay? Then what are we doing? We are starting with our vacuum. And we are inserting on our vacuum a bunch of excitations, which are some spinons, which have some upspin. And there was an even number of them always, so let me draw here 4 of them. Okay? So this would be the case when M, this would be the picture, when M is equal to 4. Okay, which I remind you would be what we would get if N1 was L over 2 minus 2. There was this fractionalization where the 4 came from just these 2. Because putting 2 less roots gives us 2 more holes, 2 more spaces, and 2 less particles, so 4 holes in total. Okay? And now I should think of these guys as a 2-component spinner with spin 1/2. Okay? Now, this is in strike contrast with the magnon, because you see the difference is that the magnon, we broke the symmetry by choosing a vacuum. The vacuum of the ferromagnetic is all spins up. So here, in this vacuum, SU2 is broken. This is totally different here, where here the vacuum preserves SU2 symmetry. SU2 symmetry is restored. The vacuum doesn't pick any direction, it's just a singlet state. So the excitations here, because the vacuum breaks the symmetry, the excitations are just spin down. And that's it, there's no, they don't have internal structure. They're just a spin down, they're just a point. But here, there's nothing special about being up. It could also be down. So this object, they transformed in the fundamental representation of SU2. So now we could imagine a situation where we take these guys, we take the same 4 spinons, right? We take the same 4 spinons. But one of them, let me draw it in a different color, I flip down. Right? This would be the case, the final case, okay, where we add some strings. Okay, which means that we flip k of the spinons from being up to being down. And that's why the total spin is m over 2 minus k. Okay? Now, be careful that I'm not saying that I put in the spin chain three particles that are spin up and one that is spin down, and that I can identify which one. I'm saying I put four particles, and the total spin is 3/2 minus 1/2. Because who is down exactly is not physical. Who is down moves. This, at some point, this flips down, this flips up. The total spin is conserved. But there is no sense in which I can say that this particle is always up, this is always down, this is always up, this is always down. Yes?
A very naive question. Yeah. The U's are related to the momentum P, right?
The capital U's or the here?
Yes.
No. You see, the only excitations that carry momenta are the thetas. They carry momenta and they carry energy. Okay? So that's related to what I want to say. I want to say that here we have two types of waves going on. Right? We have the sphere itself, right, that is moving with some momenta P of theta. Right? The particle itself moves with some momenta P of theta. And then on the lattice of M sites, we have the spin down that can be moving as a spin down. Right? Later it can be here, and then later it can be here. Like in our ferromagnetic chain. Even if these particles are stopped, even if they don't move, if they move by themselves a little bit, then okay, they would move a little bit, but this spin could also be moving, right? So we have two different movements. We have the lattice that's moving. So the movement of the lattice, so this is the movement of the lattice of spinons. And then within the lattice, if we close our eyes to their movement, there is the movement of the spins, and this movement is parameterized by these U's. So these U's are parameterizing what are called spin waves. Okay? So the energy is an energy of the particles. It doesn't care whether the particles have spin up or spin down. That makes sense. So the energy we get is just the sum of the energy of each spinner. But the equations that quantize, they are a couple set of equations that couple the spin wave degrees of freedom with the waves degrees of freedom, the momentum waves degrees of freedom. Okay? So let's just do a check of this equation. So if I don't put any k's, I get just the equation we found 2 days ago. Okay? That's one check. And another check is going to the second equation and imagining that I put the thetas to zero, which means that the particles fall asleep and the lattice is stopped. If the lattice stops, what do I get? I get u plus I over 2 over u minus I over 2 to the power m, which is propagation of a magnon in a length m, times the S matrix of magnon with magnon equal 1. So the U's are magnons that describe the spin degrees of freedom of the spinons. They're spin waves. So if you want, you can call U's, they are the magnons of the spinons. So I go to the antiferromagnetic vacuum, I preserve symmetry, I put excitations all up first, now I define the lattice. Now on this spin chain, I can now put some magnons and just let the magnons move there. Okay? And this interaction between spin waves and physical waves are described by these equations. And because you see, I do it in steps. First I put the vacuum, then I put the particles. Then on that, those particles define a new vacuum, and then I put more particles. So it's one thing inside the other, like matryoshkas. right? And that's why it's called nested Bittensatz. And this word nested comes from this nesting procedure of starting, putting particles, the particles define a new vacuum, putting magnets there to define the spin waves, and so on. Okay? Yes?
It seems to me that whether the down spin is transferred from one spin place to the other seems the same as the as if the spin place is switched. So is this not a gauge redundancy in the description?
It's very different. Imagine you are watching a movie, right? If you are watching a movie where the spin-ons are well separated, and yet you see that who is spin-down is here, after 1 minute the spin-down is here, after 1 minute the spin-down is here, and yet the spin-ons never touched. A very different movie would be a movie where you see the spin-ons moving, swapping, and the spins continue. So you will have really, it's really different.
So you impose locality.
I'm not imposing anything. I'm just finding the spectrum of the model and interpreting this equation. I'm just... If you want, yes, there is some locality in the sense that the U's move in this lattice... move in the lattice of thetas, and they know that there is a lattice of thetas, but... I don't see why I should think that it's gauge. It's really different, right? So we have spin waves and waves. The lattice moves and the spins move. It's two physical things. I don't think there's anything gauge about it. Yes?
So the picture that you've drawn is basically the holes define a totally new lattice.
The holes define a new lattice?
New lattice on which these new massless modes are propagating.
These new magnets are propagating, yeah. I would not call them massless modes. I would call them magnets. I would not call them massless modes in the sense that how many particles do we have here? 4 particles. What's the energy? It's epsilon of theta 1 plus epsilon of theta 2 plus epsilon of theta 3 plus epsilon of theta 4. So none of them is massless. There are 4 particles. It is just that there is also this degree of freedom, which is a spin wave that moves here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So could we have sort of a similar picture in the step, like all the way back in the step one, where we would also have these bound states that of just, you know, few spins flipped up and propagating around on the original lattice?
Sorry, you are asking whether I could imagine having a huge block of spins. Let me see, maybe I'm completely misunderstanding your question. But one possibility of what you're asking is the following. I have all spins down, and then I put a huge block of spins up. All spins up, and I put a huge block of spins down. And then on this huge block, I start putting some excitations moving. Okay, I could do that, but what would happen is the following. I have this huge block. And then I flip a spin in the middle and imagine that it's moving. But as soon as I flip it, now the block breaks apart and like an iceberg. So it will destroy the block. So instead of describing a block with some nested level, you would just describe 2 bound states, each of them with a smaller number of strings. So the picture here emerges. The reason why we have an extra level, so the fact that we go from one equation to 2 equations is related to the emergence of SU2 symmetry. Before, when we break SU2 symmetry to parameterize particles, all we need to tell is momenta of particles, because particles don't have inner structure. They are just spins down. When we preserve symmetry, we need one more quantum number. We need to say momenta of particles and momenta of the SU2 spin waves. So this emergence of a new equation is the emergence of SU2 symmetry. It's the restoration of SU2 symmetry. And I emphasize again, it's something very powerful. It's a check that we did no mistake. The fact that we got here plus 0 is very important. It's really the fact that this is a symmetry. We restore the symmetry. These excitations don't carry any energy. There is no energy associated to these guys, except for the fact, as I said several times, that the quantization condition is affected by the presence of these guys, and therefore the thetas will change.
So in QFT, then you have a state that preserves a symmetry, or a vacuum that preserves a symmetry, it's usually annihilated by the generators of that symmetry. What is the definition of a vacuum that preserves symmetry in this case?
It's exactly that. So this vacuum is a singlet. It's annihilated by all the generators. It has S3 equal to 0, SX equal to 0, XY equal to 0. Whereas this one does not. This one is annihilated by S plus, because you cannot put any spins more, but it's not by S minus. So here, because S minus is the only generator that doesn't annihilate it, we have only one type of particle, which is obtained by S minus. But here, because we preserve symmetry, the particles transform into multiples of SU2. Okay. Any question here? Okay. So let's now, from these equations, I want to reproduce these equations that I got a second time, but today is in a simpler way. So let's think again about our spinons, and let's consider the case where they form a state of spin 1, which is a symmetric state, versus the case where they form a singlet, a state of spin 0, which would be the singlet state. So this would be two configurations that we could have. Now imagine just two spinners. So what I want to say is that the S matrix, as a matrix of our spinons, if I want now to forget about all these equations, and I want to ask, what is the S matrix of my spinons as a function of theta 1 minus theta 2, where theta 1 and theta 2 are the moment of my spinons? Well, what is it? It's equal to a function of theta times the identity plus another function of theta times the permutation operator, because those are the only two SU2 tensors I can write. Right? Which is the same as saying that it is a function of theta times a projector into the symmetric configuration representation, plus another function of theta times the projector into the singlet or anti-symmetric representation. What are these projectors? What projects into symmetric? I symmetrize, so I do identity plus permutation over 2. And what projects into the singlet? I anti-symmetrize, identity minus projector over 2. So this F and G are just F plus G over 2 and stuff like this. Right? So you agree that these are projectors. If I square them, I get back the projector. And this projects into the two invariant subspaces. Right? Good. Now, if I go to the nested bit ansatz equations, and I want to study the case of spin 1, it's easy. I should plug k equal to 0, m equal to 2. And what do I get in that case? Why do I put k equal to 0? I put k equal to 0 and m equal to 2 because I want to study a state of spin 1. And then what do I get? I get this term is not there. And I get that the S matrix is this function S spin, and that is this gamma function that we computed yesterday. Okay? So we conclude from this case that that function there, f tilde of theta, is equal to those gamma functions, gamma, gamma, over gamma, gamma. So it is what we were calling the S matrix of the spinon as a function of theta. Right? Because I act on a symmetric state, up, up, and singlet kills it, and I get this f of theta. Do you agree? Now, to study the singlet, we analyze the case where k equal to 1 and m equal to 2. Huh? This is what we would do for the symmetric. And this is what we would do if we would like to study the singlet. Right? For the singlet, we would do k equal to 1, m equals to 2, such that we have a state with total spin 0. Right? So what do we get in that case? Well, let's look at this equation here. You see, this equation here, from the second bit equation, this term here is not there, because it's a product over b not equal to a. There's only one u, so this is not here. So you only have this term here. Okay? M is equal to 2, and there's only one u. Can someone see by head what's the solution to this equation? This product of these two terms only equal to 1? So the second bit equation gives, so the second line, so the second nested bit and Zatz equation tells me that my single u, there's only a single u, equal, what is it, as function of theta 1 and theta 2? So it is just, there's a single u, it's u minus theta 1 plus I over 2 times u minus theta 2 plus I over 2 divided by the complex conjugate equal to 1. So if you compute it, the second nested bit and Zatz equation, I don't need to compute, right? I can tell you what the solution is. Is it okay? It's obvious. So it's theta 1 plus theta 2 over 2. It's very easy because you see, it's quadratic, the equation I get, if I put the denominator, multiply it by there. But the quadratic term cancels, so it becomes linear, and the solution is this. Okay. So u is equal to this, which means that if I plug it into the first equation, which implies now, I take this solution and plug into the first equation, the first nested bit and Zatz equation. And what do I get? I get e to the I p of theta 1 times L times this S spin on of theta 1 minus theta 2, right? Because there's only one term, times theta 1 minus u, which gives me theta 1 minus theta 2 over 2 plus I over theta 1 minus theta 2 minus I. Okay. I must confess that I'm not sure about whether this is plus or minus, but we will fix it doing the exercise that we are doing now. But I was not, when I wrote it today, I was not sure if I got the signs right, but we will see. So these signs, I'm not yet sure. I have to check what we will get, and I'll tell you if it's okay or not. Because I'm not sure of the signs that I wrote here, because these signs might be wrong, so I have to check. We got this equal to 1. Right? So you see what happens is that this is the S matrix when I have a singlet. Now, so now the interpretation is that this quantity here is the singlet S matrix. So this is G tilde of theta 1 minus theta 2. Right? Because I have, again, interpretation, e to the IPL S matrix equal to 1. So what do we conclude from this? We conclude, let's write down what the S matrix as a matrix is. We conclude that the S matrix for the spinon as a matrix of theta is equal to this gamma gamma over gamma gamma. So that's what we call the scalar part without the head, S of spinon of theta that we got. And then projector into the symmetric representation plus theta plus I over theta minus I times projector into the singlet. which, if I now write it again using that this is identity plus permutation and this identity minus permutation, I get that this is equal to gamma gamma over gamma gamma times, help me out, so theta minus I theta plus I, so the I cancels and I get theta times identity and then P times theta minus I minus I and then minus I minus 2, no, because there is a 1/2 minus I times permutation divided by 1 over theta minus I. Yeah. Okay. So I'm almost positive that I got the sign wrong. So let me flip it. I'm not actually convinced, totally sure, but I think I got the sign wrong. So let me flip it. Minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, plus, plus. And what is this? This is nothing but the R matrix that we found for an SU2 spin chain evaluated at theta. Right? Remember, this was the R matrix, theta times identity plus I times permutation. So this object that we got is exactly the object that obeys our S matrix, that perfectly obeys Young-Baxter. Right? Because our matrix obeys Young-Baxter, so it was designed. So we see that we started with an R matrix first to build a spin chain. Nothing to do with scattering of anything. Now we got exactly the same object, but where the R matrix now has a very physical meaning. It's the scattering of the spins. There, the fact that our matrix obeyed Young-Baxter was responsible for this algebra and the fact that the spin chain was solvable and so on. Here, the fact that the R matrix obeys this Young-Baxter is the statement of factorization of the scattering. Right? And it had to be factorized because of the theory being integrable. So if you want another check of the equations that we did, you would see it's very non-trivial that we get two scattering components and then they combine in a precise way as to get an integrable theory. Now, we could have reverse engineered. We could have said, let me suppose I want to derive the equations for the spinons. And you see that what was hard for the spinons was to get the U's. To get just the thetas, it was relatively easy, right? It was to get the emergence of the SU2 degrees of freedom that was a bit more subtle. We had to consider the strings. It was yesterday's lecture that was a little bit technical, and it's a bit tough. So I'm going to now re-derive this equation starting from this S matrix, which is an S matrix that I knew had to be the case. I knew that the S matrix had to be some S matrix for the spinons corresponding to the scattering of up, whatever it is, times this combination here. With this normalization, you see, such that it's one acting on up. I knew it had to be like this. I did not know what this function is, but if I compute the case with thetas, I even know this function. So I could have reconstructed this without the use, just because I know it obeys Young-Baxter. So I know this is what I get when they are up, and the rest, they are spin 1/2, it must be this, right? So you agree that once we have this, so given this, we could have guessed this, the square bracket. We could have guessed the square bracket based on integrability. We did not guess, we derived it, but we could have guessed. We could have said, well, I know two components, but the other components are not independent. Young-Baxter must fix them, and this must be the S matrix. In that way of doing, I would not need to introduce the use, which was a bit subtle yesterday to see that the use are responsible for the emergence of the SU2 symmetry. But we do want the use, because we do want the complete equation. So now let's follow a slightly different logic. Let's imagine a parallel universe where this is what we did indeed. We computed the scattering of plus plus. Then we said, now that I have the scattering of plus plus, I guess the rest based on integrability. And now let me start with this S matrix. And with this S matrix, let me derive those nested bit equations. Okay? So now the logic is different. The logic is we start with the scattering of up, up. And when we scatter this up, up with each other, we read off the S matrix of the spin. Here we never need, this is just using theta j's. Then from here, we go to the full S matrix of the spin by knowing that it's completed in a way compatible with Young-Baxter. And then what we are going to do next is go from this now S matrix to this nested beta and zat equations where we will introduce here the U's. This is what we are going to do now. So this is a different logic, where instead of introducing the U's, restoring the symmetry, getting this S matrix, no, we don't restore the symmetry completely, we just scatter plus plus, but then we know by Young-Baxter how it's completed into a full matrix, and then from there we will get the U's. Yes?
Is there the 1 over theta plus I, was that also obvious from the fact that it's a matrix?
So the fact that it's an R matrix, I write it like this.
Right.
The overall factor is not fixed,
sure.
But it's fixed such that when I act on up, up, I get 1.
Okay.
Because up, up gives theta, up, up gives I, so I need to have theta plus I. So this is fixed to be the R matrix, normalized such that acting on up, up, I get 1. Because this is what I know that is the scattering of up, up. Okay? So that's what we want to do next. You see? This is conceptually a little bit more subtle because it requires this step, whereas we did not require anything so far. But it's cleaner because we just start with this component, derive this, complete it to this, and now as you'll see, this step is quite simple to do. So conceptually it's a little bit more subtle if you want, but technically it's simpler. Okay? Okay, so let's try to do it. So we have our object, which is our S matrix of the spinors, right? And what we want to do, we want to take this S matrix and impose periodicity of my wave function. I want to say that if a spinor goes around the world and scatters with the other spinors, in total, I must get 1, right? But now we must be careful. What does this mean? This means the following. It means that I take my S matrix, S, right? And I scatter theta j minus theta j plus 1. And then I scatter S of theta j minus theta j plus 2. Tack, 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 until I go all the way around, S of theta j minus 1, the last one after going around. This is a matrix. This, acting on my wave function, psi, must be equal to 1, no, not 1, sorry. This times e to the I momenta of the spinon of theta j times L must be equal to 1 times psi. This is the problem I want to diagonalize. Right? Instead of just being numbers, now it's a matrix equation. Now, this problem we want to diagonalize, and look what we diagonalized the other day. It's something not so different, right? We had the product of S matrices, which were R matrices, and we diagonalized this object here. It's not exactly the same thing, but let's make it exactly the same thing by saying, by noticing the following. Let's construct a matrix T of theta, okay, which is this object, where here I have theta, a complex variable, and here I have theta 1, theta 2, up to theta m. So you see the big difference compared to this is that instead of zeros here, I'm now putting the rapidities of the various holes, of the various spin-ons. And I construct this object, right? And now notice something nice, that t at theta j, what does it become? It becomes exactly what you want. Why? Because the S matrix of theta minus theta j, when you replace theta by theta j, becomes the S matrix of zero. But the S matrix at zero, it's exactly equal to the permutation operator. And because of that, what happens is that in this picture, what you get is that at position j, you use the permutation operator. Right? And then this becomes exactly this quantity here. Becomes exactly this product here in the second line. Do you see? So, it's exactly what we want. This is exactly what we want. This is exactly what we need. So the strategy is very simple. If we can diagonalize this object, t of theta times psi equal to some eigenvalue t of theta times psi, we first diagonalize it, step one. Step two, we impose that the eigenvalue, because we do it for any theta, because they obey Young-Baxter, so I can diagonalize it for any theta at the same time. I impose that when I replace the eigenvalue by theta j, I get that this times e to the I p of theta j times l equal to 1. Okay? So technically, it's exactly what we did, with two differences. One difference, instead of zeros, we put thetas. The second difference is when we have the eigenvalue, instead of taking a log derivative, which is what we wanted to do before, now we want to do something totally different. We want to evaluate it at theta j, multiply by exponential, and say it's equal to 1. Okay? And the third difference, if you want, is the normalization. S and R, they differ by the normalization. Okay. So this is exactly the problem we solved already. So let me indeed summarize what are the differences, because we can quote the result directly. Okay. So the only differences is now that when diagonalizing it, what do we find for t of theta? Let me write. So for t of theta, we find that it's equal to, first, there is this overall factor, which is very simple, product of S for the spinons of theta minus theta j. That's just each R matrix comes with this factor. We also do this divide by theta plus I, so that combination there will become, let me write it, and then you'll see, becomes, now I'm not shifting by I over 2, so it becomes, sorry. So So how do we diagonalize? Well, as before, we say that this is a product of B operators, but now at U1, B operator at UK acting on all spin arms up. Because it's the same thing as before. The only difference, I'm using the letter, the capital letter, otherwise it's the same. So I get product here of theta minus UK minus I over 2 over theta minus UK plus I over 2 plus the other term I shift back. So the other term, I get product over k equal 1 up to m, theta minus theta k over theta minus theta k plus I, and then product over k up to capital K, okay, bad name, but okay. Theta minus uk plus I over 2 over theta minus UK. Again, let me summarize. The fact that this is downstairs, this is just this theta plus I, so this stuff and this stuff give this thing down here and this thing down here, up here, right? So these products are just from overall normalization. The rest, all I did was, when I had this product, I replaced this zero by theta k, because now I have a theta at each side, and that gave rise to the fact that I have a product up to n, okay? And now, you see, theta, t, of theta j times e to the I p of theta j times L equal to 1. What happens when I put theta equal theta j? I cancel the second term. And what do we get from here? We get the first nested Beaton-Zatz equation. Exactly the first line up there with the U's now. And when I impose that t of theta is a polynomial, which means that there are no residues when no poles. Sorry. Here there is a mistake. So I shift by I over 2, it's 3 I over 2. Here plus. When I impose that there are no poles, when theta is equal to theta k minus I over 2, what do I get? I get a set of equations which are exactly the second nested Beaton-Zatz equation. Okay, the cancellation of these two of the residues there give me exactly the second line. So you see that given what we had done, it was technically absolutely straightforward to recover those equations without going through all this string business and so on, the restoration of symmetry. Okay?
Why did setting theta equal to theta j cancel?
Sorry, can you repeat?
Why did it cancel the second term, the theta equals to theta j?
When you put theta equal to theta j, this term it becomes zero, right? One of the terms contains
one
theta.
Of the, sure.
One of them is zero, so it's enough to vanish this, and I get just exactly the first bit equation. Okay. So now I want to just so I want to emphasize again the difference. So we have here an S matrix, and we use this S matrix. We diagonalized, we carried the particle around in matrix form. We got a problem very similar to the starting problem. We just solved it, and we got the antiferromagnetics spectrum. Okay. Now let's suppose. So this. Now changing topic, raises the following possibility. So here is an idea. And the idea is, suppose I have a strongly coupled quantum field theory. Okay? Suppose I have a strongly coupled quantum field theory. So I have a Lagrangian, and the Lagrangian is basically useless because the theory is strongly coupled. So the idea is, forget about the Lagrangian, and let's instead try to do what's called to bootstrap, which is to fix using as minimal assumptions as we can. Let's try to bootstrap directly the S matrix of my theory. If the theory is integrable, of course, assuming the theory here is an integrable theory. Otherwise, it's harder, but OK, there are also some things we can say if it's not integrable. But we could try to directly bootstrap S. Imagine I was able to fix S. And then if I fix S, then we carry through this machinery, and we get the spectrum of my quantum field theory without this needing the Lagrange.
So what do you mean by bootstrap?
Bootstrap means fixing this, constraining this S matrix by just symmetry, crossing, unitarity, some basic principles. Okay, so the idea of the bootstrap is that you lift yourself by your bootstraps. You push yourself and you float in the air. So very simple idea. For example, in our case, when we had the spinans, we could have guessed everything about these equations up to this function S spinan of theta. That function gamma gamma over gamma gamma, just by symmetry, we could not have guessed. But everything else, the structure of the equations, everything I could have written. So I could have written the first blackboard, except the lower right corner, just based on the fact that I know the theory is integrable and it has SU2 symmetry. Then all I had to do is ask an experimentalist to measure this S spinan for two particles. He would measure with a neutron scattering experiment, and then I would just plug it in the equations and get then the rest of the spectrum. Okay? So that's an example. Okay? So the idea is to combine symmetry, Young-Baxter. If the theory is Lorentz invariant, combine Lorentz invariant, which in particular means also crossing symmetry, the fact that you can exchange time and space, unitarity, analyticity often, analyticity. And often some luck, because often there are many solutions and we need to make some guess, and then test, luck plus tests of the guess. And the idea is that often this leads then to an S matrix that we can then use to compute the spectrum of the theory.
So you said that factorization implies integrability, right?
It's the definition for me of integrability.
Is it different only?
No, it's a definition. So you cannot argue against definitions. Right? I define it as being definitions.
So, but I guess what I want to ask is, can you have theories that have that do not factorize, but you can still, for example, exactly solve for the spectrum?
Yeah, you can.
So you can have non-integrable theories that
in that particular sense? Yeah, so there are some theories that don't have an interpretation of particles.
Mm-hmm.
There are some complicated lattice models, and this notion of localized particles that move doesn't exist, and nonetheless, you can still solve those statistical models exactly. That would be an example.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. So, for example, suppose I take these spin chains, I construct the Hamiltonian still as a log derivative of a view, but for example, at a different point u.
Mm-hmm.
I get a super messy and local Hamiltonian. There's no longer, and yet I can solve it exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's maybe not a good example. A better example is if I put impurities on my spin chain. If I put some thetas like we did there, then I get an unlocal Hamiltonian and I can still solve. Okay. So let me tell you some example. So an example would be the ON sigma model. We said this is a complicated model and I don't know how to solve it. I know that I have some S matrix, right, that has some indices. AB goes to CD, where these indices A runs from 1 to n. This was based on the idea that we thought particles were vectors under ON. But suppose, then other than that, the Lagrangian was basically useless. And even this was a large n computation. If it's not large n, okay, it's already an assumption. Then, for example, the first thing you can say is that this S matrix is a function of theta, where theta is theta 1 minus theta 2, where this theta 1 and theta 2 are related to the energy of particle 1 and 2 and momentum. So energy and momentum of particle 1 are m cosh theta 1 sinh theta 1. And for particle 2, energy of particle 2, momentum of particle 2, it's m cosh theta 2 sinh theta 2. And the fact that it's only a function of the difference, this here, I'm already using Lorentz invariance, because boosts are translations in theta. So invariance under boosts implies that it's only a function of the difference of thetas. Okay? So this is already Lorentz, or if you want, boost invariance. But then, I know it's a function of theta. But I know it should be a function of theta. And then I have to write things with these indices. I can write delta AC, delta BD. But I could also write some other function g of theta times delta AD, delta BC. And I could also write another function h of theta times, you see, because it's ON and not SUN, A and B can also be contracted, and C and D can be contracted there. So these are three possible ON tensor structures. Okay? And now we have two things. We have Young-Baxter. We know the model is integrable. Well, actually, you don't. I do, but I could construct some charges for you, and then you would also know, because these extra charges exist, so we can construct the charges. So the model is integrable, so we impose this equation. And we also impose the equation that if you write the S matrix with indices A, B, C, D, which means that I have my indices. And now it's super dangerous what I'm going to do, because I'm not 100% sure. So A, let me use this notation, C, D, B, with some incoming rapidity theta, I could ask, what is it when I replace theta by I pi minus theta, which is this angle here, I pi minus theta. Because you see that what you do if you replace I pi minus theta. If you replace theta by I pi minus theta, this, which is, if you want, the two momenta of particle 1, become minus E1 P1 under theta 1 goes to I pi minus theta 1. So you see, it flips the sign of the energy. Right? So this flips. So this means that what was particle 1, which was this momentum here, theta 1, and here it's theta 1, this gets flipped from the past to the future, and this gets flipped from the, sorry, this from the past to the future, and this from the future to the past. If I flip particle and antiparticle. So I get that this at I pi minus theta is equal, it's the same as flipping D to the past, So I bring this D, I would bring it down, and this guy I would bring up. So there was B here, and now D is here. B and D, and then now in the past there is A and C evaluated at theta. Okay? And this is what's called crossing symmetry. It is just a statement that I can look at the S matrix from here, or I can look at it from here. Exchange time and space and see the same result. And now you see that if you impose this equation, okay, with these two equations, it turns out, you plug these equations using this X matrix, that you can fix all these three functions up to an overall function, which means you can fix, say, G over F and H over F. Okay? So only F of theta is unfixed. Okay? Then you impose unitarity. Unitarity is the statement that if I scatter twice, I do nothing. Which means that S of theta times S of minus theta equal to the identity matrix. And this gives a functional equation for this F of theta. And then you solve it, and you get, now this solution has many solutions, and you get a guess for F of theta, and you solve the strongly coupled field theory without ever using a Lagrange. Okay? Now, this part here is what you are going to do in today's tutorial. So today's tutorial is precisely about implementing this. Taking the ON model, playing with Young-Baxter crossing unitarity to see that indeed these very basic principles lead to a single equation for a single function, and then you will plug a solution and check that that at least we have one solution. Yes?
So this is solved just by assuming the symmetry, ON symmetry, right?
ON symmetry, and integrability, crossing, symmetry. That was led to a single equation for F.
Could we write down, say, different Lagrangians with the same symmetry?
So then the different Lagrangian must be here. This equation must have different solutions. So here, different theories are different solutions to this equation. Until this step, everything must be universal. So it's this single functional equation that we write, whose solution is not unique, that parameterizes the various solutions with ON symmetry. An example, when n is equal to 4, the S matrix for the O4 sigma model, for the S matrix of the O4 sigma model, it's equal to a bunch of gamma functions, gamma square, times identity plus identity times theta plus I times permutation tensor with identity times theta plus I times permutation, where let me explain what I did here. Here I use the fact that O4 is equal to SU2 times SU2, right? That I can always decompose a vector of O4 into two indices of SU2, A and A bar. And the S matrix decomposes into the left and right SU2. And the decomposition gives what? Gives one R matrix of SU2 left and one R matrix of SU2 right. So of course it obeys Young-Baxter. Is it clear? And then what's the prefactor? And there is here this theta plus I, such that acting on up-up gives one, and theta plus I. And what is this matrix we get? It's gamma gamma over gamma gamma. And in fact, it's fun that this is nothing but the same S matrix of the spinons that we got before. It's the same combination of gamma 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 gamma, so the difference is that we get this square here. And of course, the difference is that the dispersion relation is now cos theta and sin theta, and not the complicated one we got before. But nonetheless, the fact that it is so similar makes us think, can't we find a lattice discretization of this model such that when we then go to some complicated antiferromagnetic vacuum, that we get this S matrix? Can't we go to the computations we did and find a missing factor of 2 and change the model a little bit to get the 2 there? And then change a little bit some impurities to get this dispersion rather than the one we got. So the first 10 minutes of tomorrow, I'll tell you a little bit on how we would go about doing that. Okay, thank you.
Is tomorrow your last lecture? Or is it...
Tomorrow will be my last lecture, I think. Unless you ask Kevin, and Kevin wants to give me more lectures.
you want to ask him or...
Want to? You can ask him. You can ask.
Okay.
Any questions?